call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Monday, April 4th, 2005. We have three items on the agenda today. We're going to have a public hearing on two issues, looking at expanding affordable health insurance to small purchasers, small employers, and individuals, and covering children. We also have a bill that is building upon the work. This is House Bill 2800, building upon the work of two sessions ago to clarify mandatory overtime requirements for nurses. And so we're going to take that bill first out of order. Colleagues, at 9:30, I'm told that there's a Republican caucus being held at 9:30, so we'll probably keep going, and we'll excuse the members who would like to participate in that caucus and just come back down after you're done with the caucus. I suspect it probably won't be that long. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2800, and we will invite Susan King with the Oregon Nurses Association forward, Ken Rutledge with the hospitals, and Mr. Bruce Anderson, legislative director for the Speaker of the House. Good morning, welcome.
Morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Anderson with the House Speaker's Office. Here to testify in support of House Bill 2800 and the Dash 1 amendments that you have before you. I'm not going to speak very long, only to say that the Speaker introduced this bill at the request of the Nurses Association, bringing forward this issue, and we've been working with the Nurses Association and the Hospitals Association on the Dash 1 amendments that you have before you today. It's been a wonderfully collaborative process, and I just want to laud and thank the nurses and the hospital associations for their diligence and work on this. And I will turn this over to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association and an emergency department staff nurse in Portland. I would like to echo Mr. Anderson's comments. I have greatly appreciated his work on behalf of the Speaker, the Speaker's willingness to work with us on this bill, and most particularly my colleague Ken Rutledge, the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We are bringing forward to you today a critical issue that we believe needs to be addressed by this legislature to strengthen the existing law regarding nurse staffing in hospitals. But we are bringing to you some compromise amendments that we believe are appropriate and will get us where we need to be, but do it in a way that we can agree to. A marked change from 2001, having been involved in that legislation as well. Just briefly, I'd like to make some comments about what the current bill, but most specifically the amendments, will do to this bill. The two major areas in the bill relate first to mandatory overtime limitations for nurses, that is registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and certified nursing assistants in acute care facilities, or what we call hospitals. The second provision is how will the staffing plan for any hospital be developed. The existing law does address both of those issues as well. In 2001, this legislature passed mandatory overtime limits that are going to be strengthened and made clearer in this bill. Previously, mandatory overtime was limited to 16 hours per day. We have reduced that limit to 12 per 24 and 48 per 7-day work week period because our experience and the research tells us that those are limits that are most appropriate when you're considering the safety of patient care. We have allowed, as with the existing legislation, we have allowed variances for such things as disaster plans or when there's a declared emergency, and as Mr. Rutledge and I have worked out, changes in the language, a one-hour period at the end of a shift when unforeseen circumstances occur, such as a patient goes into a crisis and the nurse caring for that patient cannot leave. The second area in the bill, most specifically clarified in the amendments we're bringing to you, is how will the staffing plan be developed? It is our belief that the best and most appropriate staffing plan for an individual facility is developed by the experts in that facility. We've not taken a prescriptive approach. We believe that the nursing professionals in any given hospital can make a staffing plan that fits their specific needs, whether you're a large urban hospital or a small rural hospital. So the amendments to the bill require that there be a committee, a formal committee, that that committee be composed of equal numbers of direct care registered nurses and nursing managers, nursing administrators, and that together they come up with the staffing plan that will exist for all units in the facility. The staffing plans, the basis of the staffing plan is the patient need and the requirements for nursing care. That hasn't changed, although the language has been strengthened. So those are the major provisions of this current bill. Most specifically, as I said, the amendments that we're bringing forward to you, which we believe clarify the intent of the bill and make it easier and more manageable to understand. So at this point, I will turn this over to Mr. Rutledge, and I'll be happy at the end to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Rutledge. I'm president of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. The first thing I want to say is having gone through the experience in 2001 when the first version of this legislation was passed, this has been a much more successful process, and I have to give credit to the Oregon Nurses Association. They actually came and met with us at my office prior to the beginning of this session to begin a discussion. I also want to express my appreciation for the Speaker's office. They gave us a venue in which we could sit down and begin working these things through. My major concern was to make certain that this legislation is workable for not only our large hospitals but our small hospitals. And I will tell you that throughout the process where we have discussed the amendments to the original proposed bill, we have had nurse executives from large hospitals, from small rural hospitals, from Coos Bay, from Baker City, from Ontario, from the Portland metro area, from Eugene, from Southern Oregon. So we've had adequate input, and our nurse executives believe that they can work within the framework of these new requirements. And so I will merely leave it at that. We support the bill as it is being proposed to be amended, and we think it is workable, and we think it will be of value in continuing to find ways to enhance and improve the quality of care in Oregon hospitals.
Thank you, Mr. Ratliff. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Rutledge or Ms. King, does the bill speak to how we generate additional nursing staff in the state of Oregon? I understand there's a rather critical shortage of nursing in the state of Oregon.
Well I don't, Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill does not address that issue. However, I will say there are other efforts going on. Most of those voluntary, working not only with the Nurses Association, but the community colleges and the universities. A lot of partnerships are going on, trying to find ways to generate additional nursing slots and find creative ways of financing those through private and public partnerships. So this bill does not address that issue.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Next, we'll invite Brandy Benedict with Multnomah County forward, Linda Mill with Coos County forward, and we'll have those two for now. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brandy Benedict. I am currently an emergency department registered nurse practicing in the Portland area hospital. And for the past 4 years, I've watched the progression of House Bill 2800. This is actually the third time I've testified in support of changes to the bill. In my 5 years of nursing practice, I have seen a dramatic increase in the acuity and the number of patients cared for in my department without subsequent staffing increases. My department is frequently understaffed. When we actually do have adequate staffing, we are grateful to have the collaboration needed to adequately care for our critically ill patients, to get things done quickly, to address emergent situations, and to give every staff member a break. I often find that I'm forced out of necessity to give most of my attention to critically ill patients, and so I'm not able to give appropriate attention to all of my patients. Thorough assessments, monitoring, and evaluation of interventions for most patients are often overdue because acutely care patients take priority. It was my hope 4 years ago that House Bill 2800 would provide my hospital and other facilities with the guidelines and direction necessary to appropriately staff hospital units with registered nurses and other necessary support staff. However, there is still work to be done to ensure the safe and timely bedside care of our patients. In the emergency department, we address life and death issues every night. My role as a registered nurse is not only that of clinician and caregiver, but also as an educator and a liaison between patient and physician. At no time is this more apparent than during the dying process. Recently, I had the privilege of caring for a patient and his family during the last hours of his life. The patient had a fatal injury but remained on life support until the family arrived. Subsequently, at each step of his dying process, I explained to the family what they would see in their loved one and answered their questions. I remained with the family to reassure them and to continue to answer their questions. In that role, I was exclusively their nurse and caregiver for several hours. When the time was right for me to step out and allow the family to grieve alone, I returned to my other patients who were in varying stages of need. Without enough staff to cover my other patients, they remained in waiting for medications and attention and care. Effective patient teaching and subsequently patient health is compromised due to insufficient nurse time with each patient. During discharge, patients and caregivers are taught such things as dressing changes, medication management, and home care issues. Elderly patients, caregivers, new parents, and non-English-speaking patients often require additional time in discharge teaching to assess their understanding and address their questions and concerns. However, nursing care is so rushed that discharges are done amidst other emergent patient care, and non-emergent needs may go unnoticed or delayed. As a result, patients receive substandard care and discharge teaching, which is unacceptable. The proposed changes to House Bill 2800 give some hope to a staff nurse like me. The current law allows for input from clinical staff regarding staffing plans, but does not give such input, make such input required, nor does it give such input any authority. As the law currently reads, there is also no assurance that facilities will seek out input from clinical staff. The proposed changes to the bill will ensure that bedside nurses, who have the real expertise in nursing care, have a voice in their hospital unit staffing plan. That such a staffing plan be developed, monitored, evaluated, and modified by a committee including direct patient care nurses, rather than managers and administrators alone, would ensure that staffing plans be realistic and appropriate to each unit. Having the proposed periodic quality evaluation will ensure that staffing plans remain realistic and appropriate and reflect changes in patient populations over time. Who better to determine what constitutes a safe staffing plan than the nurses who work at the bedside? In the emergency department, patients enter the system three ways: via ambulance, through the front door, and as transfers from other facilities. Many times, our department is overwhelmed by the volume and acuity of patients and further strained by insufficient staffing. Financial incentives to keep the doors open often override any concern for safe staffing and adequate patient care. It is a rare occasion when patients are diverted from our hospital. At present, the nurse manager and house supervising nurse at my hospital make a decision primarily based on bed availability in the hospital, without regard for the concerns or judgment of direct care nursing staff. I would like to see the proposed change to House Bill 2800, which requires a formal process for limiting admissions and diverting patients when, in the judgment of a registered nurse, there is a risk of harm to existing and new patients or the inability to meet the needs of current patients safely. The proposed changes to House Bill 2800 give registered nurses a voice in how their units are staffed by requiring hospitals to develop, monitor, evaluate, and modify staffing plans with registered nurses, and by giving credence to the judgment of direct care nurses when we say we cannot take another patient because it puts the safety of our patients at risk. Better, safer, more timely patient care can become a reality, but we need House Bill 2800 and its proposed changes to give nurses who provide direct care an equal voice in the quality of our practice environment. As registered nurses, we balance our roles of clinician and caregiver, educator and liaison. Please support these changes to House Bill 2800. I'll be happy to answer questions at the end.
Thank you. Linda.
Thank you. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Linda Mill. I've worked full-time as a director nurse also for 20-plus years in an acute care facility in Southern Oregon. I'm from a rural area. I would like first to thank you for your work on creating House Bill 2800, and especially for looking at the positive changes that I see when I look at the revisions that have been proposed. I've had the opportunity to be directly involved in creating a staffing model for my unit. We started work on that just shortly after the original law was laid out. We had some training, so I went to my supervisor and requested that our unit be able to create that task force, and we were given that opportunity. Our task force is created with two registered nurses from each of three shifts, so we have the direct care nurse input, our unit supervisor, as well as our director of nurses who periodically attends our meetings. So we've been working, creating that model for quite some time now, and we have implemented it on a trial basis. The only problem that we found with that is it's been closed to our unit. Our intermediate care unit is filing that. When we're short-staffed, our hospital does call in agency nurses from time to time that are available. They're not as easy to get out in the rural area. Part of that speaks to the nursing shortage, which has allowed us to begin to look at some creative issues in that regard that has nothing to do with the House bill, but it has forced us to be a little bit more creative to get those nurses. Most of our nurses come from the other units. When they pull those nurses from the other units, it leaves their units woefully understaffed. They, at this time, are not allowed to use this law to help their own situation. Our situation at times is improved with our staffing, but our sister units out there are hurting in the process. So when I looked at the things that you're looking at changing here, when I looked at Section 2.2a through 2c, which establishes that collaborative committee that has decision-making authority, which will allow this process, it'll allow us to take this trial throughout our hospital at one time and look at it across the board. Being able to have members of that committee be from every supervisor, every unit, gives me a lot of hope that in the long run we'll solve this issue much quicker than what we've been doing. It's taken a very long time for us to get where we're at on our unit. So I'm looking forward to those changes being implemented. In the process of that, the direct care nurses who are on this committee are then given that authority that we need. We're the ones at the bedside. We know whether or not we're in trouble out there with these patients, if we can take more patients or not. So I'm looking forward to having that go across the board, not just in our unit. We don't take that responsibility lightly, which is something else I'm looking forward to. In the climate on our unit, you get a little tired of being understaffed all the time. And you get to be a little complacent after a while. This law gave many of us on our unit a chance to go, wait a minute, we have an opportunity to make some change here. So we're going to step up to the plate. And to see the rest of our nurses step up to the plate and take that responsibility back is something I'm looking forward to. It's not cost effective for us to nurse the way we're nursing now from a reactionary mode. It's cost effective in the long run, when we can step in and stop things from happening. When you're understaffed, you end up running from room to room, taking care of patients, and all of a sudden you have a patient who's gone bad on you, and you now have to intervene and fix that situation, where it's much more cost-effective if we can be in there at the bedside for more periods of time to know that a patient's in trouble long before that happens. There's not a lot of glory involved in that, because nobody sees the fact that you let a fire not happen. You always see the fire we put out, and that fire means dollar signs. It's much cheaper if we can get in ahead of time and stop it from happening. I'll give you an example of that before I end my testimony, because you have a copy of my written testimony. I had a patient who was admitted who had been syncopal at home. He'd been passing out, so they brought him in. He'd been in the hospital for almost 2 days. His blood pressure was normalizing. He was able to be up and about. He was looking pretty good, but they couldn't figure out why he'd had this episode. So he was looking at having a lot of expensive tests done. That particular day, I was staffed appropriately, so I was able to spend some time to talk with him. In the process of talking to him, this man also has a seizure disorder. It wasn't part of his primary diagnosis, so it wasn't something anybody was looking at. Well, the problem is he'd been having breakthrough seizures for about 3 weeks. So during my conversation with him, I happened to ask about his medications at home. No changes had been made, but he had just refilled his prescription 3 weeks before. I asked him if he had his pills with him, and he did. This gentleman took 4 anti-seizure pills in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, 4 in the evening. 1 blood pressure pill in the morning, 1 blood pressure pill in the evening. The problem is the dispensing pharmacy had incorrectly filled his bottles, which I would not have known had I not had time to talk to him. Take his pills to our pharmacy and have them analyzed. They had accidentally filled his anti-seizure medication with all blood pressure medication. So he was taking not only 4 extra blood pressure pills in the morning, plus his original 1, 3 in the afternoon, total of 5 at night. We would have sent him home back to those pills, back to the same problem that brought him in. We would have solved nothing. His health care costs would have skyrocketed because he would have had all these tests done to figure out what was wrong with him. We wouldn't have figured out what was wrong with him. But we would have had him readmitted. So the time, not just for the dying, not just for all our normal everyday things, but for those odd things that nurses are very good about being nosy for, that's the time we need. Luckily, the gentleman was able to get his medication straightened out. We've not seen him back. He's been fine. The seizures are under control again. Blood pressure under control again. It was a win-win situation. I'm not seeing a lot of win-win situation right now with the way staffing has been. I'm tired of sending my patients to ICU when normally I would have stopped that process before I had to send them. The other units on the floor have places they can send patients when they're in trouble. I only have 2. ICU in the morgue. That's it. I fear for ICU because they only have the morgue. So I just really want to thank you for looking at this House bill. The original House bill was a ray of hope. The changes that have been proposed in this, I think, will allow us the opportunity to go farther and go and make that change sooner. And I just want to thank you for this opportunity to come before you and testify.
Thanks very much, Linda. Questions or comments from the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Brandy. Brandy, in looking at your prepared testimony on page 2, the penultimate paragraph, the last sentence of that, you're proposing an additional amendment to House Bill 2800, which would require a formal process for limiting admissions and diverting patients when, in the judgment of a direct care nurse, there is a risk of harm to existing and new patients or an ability to meet the needs of the patients safely. Is that a workable model in all hospitals, do you think?
Honestly, I don't know how it would work in the real world. If this were, in fact, followed through on and direct care nurses were given the authority to make a decision and pull the stop and say, look, this is enough, I can't take any more, it would be phenomenal.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. You work in a hospital with several hundred nurses, I take it.
Oh, absolutely.
So what would you do? Would you gather together and have a meeting and majority rules? Or?
Any ideas, please?
We can flesh that out. I just had one other question in that regard, and that is that there's a period called the golden hour. Is that familiar? I'm not a medical practitioner, but I think there's a term called the golden hour, and I represent a lot of very small hospitals, the largest district in the state of Oregon, southeastern Oregon. My concern is that if we're going to gather the nurses together and they have a vote and the majority rules to say, yes, divert that ambulance, we're really busy right now, and that ambulance is on the way to St. Charles, and you say, well, turn it around and have it head another direction, wouldn't that have the effect of extending that goal?
But as it stands, we have diversion situation possibilities all the time. It's a common practice in Portland area hospitals because it is such a busy area. We go on what's called zone management, where if, say, my hospital is on divert, another hospital in that area will be taking patients. The golden hour is absolutely essential. But unfortunately, what happens is if a patient comes to a hospital that is already overwhelmed and understaffed, they're not going to get adequate care. The golden hour at that point is out the window. If you don't have adequate care, you don't have adequate staffing, it's not going to matter if you're at my hospital or you're 15 minutes away. Because if the hospital 15 minutes away has good staffing, that patient's going to get stellar care. If they come to a hospital that says, well, we're keeping our doors open, we're kind of on the edge as it is, we don't have enough staff to really give this patient the full gusto we've got, they're not going to get the best care. So sometimes, you know, it's a better option for a patient to go, you know, the further away hospital if they're going to get better care. Paramedics do treat on the way, and that's where, you know, the most important thing is getting stuff started. But unfortunately, if you send a patient to a hospital just because its doors open, doesn't mean it's going to give good care and doesn't mean the patient's necessarily going to get the kind of attention they need without the staffing that's appropriate. So,
Mr. Chair, I just would express concern about this kind of approach where you'd have to be pulling the nurses perhaps that are on duty at that hospital and on other hospitals, and then particularly in rural hospitals, that could be a very, very significant problem of extending the time period that it would take to get a patient. And please be aware that in some cases we just have to call nurses in when we otherwise would not have the nurse-to-patient ratio.
Thanks, Representative Butler. Yeah, I haven't seen any amendments to that that are responsive to this point, so I'm not sure.
Thank you very much.
That's been worked. Representative Cameron?
Yeah, I wanted to make a point of clarification in the amendments of the lines 1 through 39 in the original bill that would allow for that, for nurses to make those types of decisions. So that's gone now, right, is the way I understand the bill with the amendments in it. That's part of the negotiation that's been taken out as it sits before us today.
Chair Dalto and Representative Cameron, Susan King again for the Oregon Nurses Association. Actually, the amendments retain the process that I believe Representative Butler and Brandy Benedict spoke to, and it is on page 2 of the printed amendments. Toward the bottom of the page, it's item E. Include a formal process for evaluating and initiating limitations on admissions or diversion, et cetera, to the end of the sentence. And in response to Representative Butler's concern,
can you tell us what line you're on?
In the printed amendments, those are lines 21 through 24.
Thanks.
On the second page. The process that we envision, and again, the work that we have done on this bill does not dictate any specific process. It doesn't require that all the nurses in the hospital would need to vote on whether the diversion would occur or limitations. And certainly the approach to making a decision like this would be different. I also practice in a large urban medical center emergency department, and we have options. Patients in the Portland metro area can be diverted to other facilities that aren't as critically busy or who have open beds. The process that would be used by a small rural hospital would be quite different, and that would probably be working with the physician community to affect discharges. Diversion to other hospitals in a small rural facility is a very different event than it is in a large Portland facility. So all this amendment does is say that the hospital has to have a process. It doesn't prescribe what that process is. It leaves it, again, to the judgment of the professionals in that facility to make the decision.
Question of Ms. King. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Ms. King, so as I look on line 23 on page 2, the direct care registered nurse is one person in each hospital each shift. Is that correct?
It refers to really any direct care registered nurse.
So the direct care nurses throughout the hospital then would have the ability to get together and vote as to whether or not that ambulance keeps coming that direction?
We didn't envision that it would necessarily need to be a group of nurses voting. What we envision this process to be, just say, for example, that I'm the nurse who believes that the conditions in my particular department are such that we could not accept another patient, or that we would need to move patients from our unit to another unit or discharge them or whatever. This amendment allows me to say, let's have a discussion about whether we can limit admissions or we can divert to another facility. And my guess would be, as we work out the specifics of how this is going to play out on the ground, that that would be a discussion I have with the nurse manager, with the house supervisor. But what this amendment really does is says there is authority for a direct care registered nurse to initiate that conversation, whereas in the current law there is no provision for this.
Mr. Chair, I just don't understand the hierarchy. Is the nurse manager a person that directs the direct care nursing and all of the rest of the folks?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, yes, generally in most facilities.
Mm-hmm. So that person wouldn't have this authority, but the majority of the nurses would, as I understand what you're saying.
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, the intent of this amendment is to say that I as the direct care registered nurse, can initiate the process. It doesn't mean I make the final decision. It means I get to initiate a discussion around whether we should be diverting or limiting admissions. And that discussion in any hospital that I'm ever aware of would occur with the direct care registered nurses, with the charge nurses, the house supervisor, and the nurse manager. So it simply says that my judgment about initiating a discussion is now going to be a part of the law.
Mr. Chair, this appears to be cumbersome, and I'm not a hospital type, so I wouldn't know anything about that. But I just am asking because it would appear to me that if you had five or six of these direct care nursing folks and a nurse supervisor, the nurse supervisor says, yes, let the ambulance come, and two of the three or two of the five nurses say, no, we don't want to, and the other three say, yes, we can go ahead and assimilate that, then I don't know whether it's a formal vote or just what. It just appears to be cumbersome, and I'm just expressing some anxiety about that. But I don't want to belabor that point any further, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are we going beyond the emergency room in these admitting sort of decisions? I suspect we are.
Yes.
So then you must have somebody, a hospital must have somebody who's making the decision about admissions. I mean, I'm sure there's some kind of admissions sort of administrator. So I mean, I guess to represent Butler's point, I don't understand why the direct care nurses can't have a conversation with the people that are responsible for admitting and sort of make them aware of the issues that the direct care nurses are seeing.
Chair Dalto, that is certainly permissible in any hospital today. And yes, the intent of this amendment does go beyond the emergency department. That just happens to be what my frame of reference is in my clinical practice. But what we are trying to get to is that there are some facilities where even when the nurses who are providing direct care say, we believe that admission should be limited, we believe that we should divert for a period of time, 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, advice is not necessarily accepted. Again, we are not in this amendment saying that the direct care registered nurses have the final say. We are simply wanting to say that the facility has to have a process. And my expectation that would be that any facility, the process would be that the direct care staff say, let's discuss how we can do this. And that discussion would happen with the house supervisor, who would most typically be a nurse, with the nurse manager, who generally is a nurse, and with other members of administration. That's the way we think it would work.
So I guess, are you saying that there are facilities out there now that don't have a process for when to cut off admissions?
Chair Dalto, yes, I am saying that. Or if the process exists, it's not known universally across the facility to all those practicing in it. So, again, we're leaving this to be whatever the facility determines to be the process, but we're incorporating the judgment of the direct care providers in it.
Why not work that out at the provider level, at the facility level? why do you need to change the law to do that particular point?
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, as with any of the changes that we proposed both in 2001 and in 2005, we believe that there needs to be a set of guidelines established so that facilities and the practitioners within them know what needs to be incorporated into a staffing plan. And in our judgment, this is a valid part of the staffing plan, is not only providing care, but knowing when you would need to limit care or when you would need to call in resources. So we do intend that all of these provisions are worked out at the facility level, hence the lack of a very prescriptive approach.
Okay, Representative Boone.
And I only have experience with small rural hospitals, so maybe I can relate to Rep. Butler, too, and just share a little bit about what happens in our area, and it's Seaside and Astoria hospitals. So, for an example, if there's a big MBA, two or three cars, two patients in each car, the ambulance, there's only four ambulances in Clatsop County, they have six patients, they're going to have to double up. And at that point, everything gets, it just starts from there. People are in contact by radio, by fire radio, on the HERO radio with the hospitals. They put Lifelight on standby. If they can fly, we know it right away, or sometimes, most likely, the Coast Guard has doubled up there. But those are the kinds of things I don't think you can really plan for, but to have something in effect that you can draw on if the hospital's full, and for in our case, if it's a trauma entry, Seaside can't take them unless it's really, I mean, they just grab them and run, they move things in the they meet people on the highway, they transfer wherever the helicopter can land. It's nothing that can be really static. And I think they just take it as it is. People know what to do, and they know how many they can take. And all the trauma people have to go to Astoria or fly to Portland or ground transfer to Portland. So if, in fact, you all of a sudden in a small hospital setting like that get all these extra patients, things happen at the hospital level. They call in all the on-call ambulance drivers, and they shift things around, and sometimes other things happen. But they do what they need to do. But I think what I'm hearing you say is you need to have something in place that you can draw upon to make those decisions, because some of the people that might come into the hospital or are in the ER are going to be moved or changed or sit there or whatever, but if there has to be a plan that allows this kind of fast action to take place. And I don't know, maybe I'm not seeing it right. At a big hospital, it's probably a little bit different. So, and I'm only talking about in an emergency situation, but that might affect in a small hospital the regular people who are just coming in, or people who are coming to the ER because they don't have medical care, and all of a sudden they're coming to a place where they can wait, but you know, so, and I really can see it, and plus you might have it happen right at shift change, and then what do? I mean, people are going to have to stay on.
Okay, Representative Anderson and Greenlight.
Thank you. I have two questions. First, are these decisions being made before the time that an ambulance is on the way? Are there cumulative decisions made by the primary nursing staff and the supervisory people and the hospital saying we're up to capacity, any calls come in for the next hour or two?
Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, let me just give you an example how it works in the Portland metro area. And again, I can't emphasize enough that we know it's different in the small rural facilities. In the Portland metro area, we have the emergency departments have worked out a system, and we actually have a computer where you can look any minute and find which hospital is accepting patients and not. What we do is sometimes we go on what is called total ambulance divert. That means that no ambulance can bring a patient to that facility, but that's known in advance.
Okay.
Once we receive a call and accept that ambulance call and they're on their way, they're our patient. So this isn't this kind of a process doesn't stop a transport and doesn't, you know, disenfranchise that patient that's on his or her way.
Great. Follow-up? Another question. Explain to me the balance between how much of these decisions have been made now by the nursing staff and how much by the hospital administration. Are both involved, or?
Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, I think there's great variability across the state. I think in some cases there probably is a collaborative process where the nurses on a particular unit are saying, we've got to do something here, we can't accept more patients, or we need to discharge some patients, and that decision is made jointly. In other places, not.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
I have a couple of questions. First, I'm not certain how this whole mandatory shift limit actually works on the ground. I wonder if we can talk about it. I've had more experience than I wanted to in hospitals in the last couple of years and have personally seen instances where nurses double shift. And it always seems like for good reasons, and mostly because they're not willing to leave their charges in a situation. I mean, am I imagining that actually happened, or are there nurses that are double shifting, say, even in the hospital that you've been known to work at?
Representative Dalto and Representative Greenlick, not speaking, of course, to any medications you might have been taking at the time.
Or my wife was taking, which is just as bad.
or Mrs. Greenlick. Nurses do sometimes work double shifts. And I want to be very clear, what we're bringing before you is not any prohibition to voluntary overtime. All of us do at times. All of us certainly do if there's a disaster or a declared emergency. And nothing in this bill prohibits that. This bill only speaks to when a nurse can be mandated to work longer than the limits that are expressed in the law.
Yeah, follow up with a different question. Now, in the real world, there are a variety of things that happen in the environment of an institution. I mean, I've actually heard, I know this seems unreasonable, but times when doctors have been cranky and unreasonable, I know you will know that, or hospital administrators have been cranky and unreasonable, or maybe even nurses have been cranky and unreasonable. How do we make sure that the right criteria really are being used at the time? I think it is very important, I agree with you, to make sure that there's real world working nurse input into the situation, and I think it's also true of, say, ER docs and unit managers in this, but is it, and I don't know if we can do this by statute, but is there some way to make sure that when there's concerns expressed by any number of these people, the concerns are really based on legitimate, valid, universal criteria rather than, say, somebody having a bad day?
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlick, I would answer you in two ways. First of all, it is my personal belief and the belief of hundreds and hundreds of members of my organization that the decision about how long one can work should be left to the individual.
Absolutely.
Only I know when I'm starting to have to repeat myself three times to a patient or having to double check, triple check, quadruple check medications that I'm ready to give. So I would say that as the first answer. But the second answer, I think, is becoming more compelling as we start to look at the research. We've all been, for the last 4 or 5 years, talking about the Institution of Medicine studies related to errors in our healthcare system, not hospitals only. And we're beginning to see a research base emerge that clearly documents that there are certain limits that are probably appropriate. one of the recent articles, which I actually provided to you, talks about risk for error increasing dramatically after 12 hours of work. We know that when you start looking at medication errors, there is literature that talks about the 11th hour of a 12-hour shift being when those errors start to occur. So we're trying to combine in the bill for you both our experience, both the responsibility and the accountability of an individual practitioner not to work beyond the time that we're safe, and some limits that we believe have a basis in research.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up just briefly. No, I don't disagree. I absolutely agree with that. That I think, and I think sometimes people, even voluntarily, both physicians and nurses, and probably administrators, work beyond where they ought to be working to be safe. I'm talking about the reaction to that concern, as opposed to me having to shut me down because I've reached a point where I'm unsafe, or putting limits on the individual that we know is unsafe, versus culling management decisions about unit closures and a variety of other things. That's the area that I think the bill speaks to. Absolutely, I don't believe any nurse or physician should work beyond what's safe, and I agree with you, the data are very, very clear. But it's a question of making the management decision. It's time to close down the ER because I'm beyond my capacity to serve. That's the issue I think we have to make sure we understand those decisions are being made on solid ground.
Okay, thanks for your comment, Representative Greenlee. Thanks to each member of the panel and also to Susan King. Next, we're going to invite Dr. Marvin Spickle forward with the Oregon State Hospital. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Dalto, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marvin Fickle. I am the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. With me today is Ms. Kathleen Schmale, who is the administrator of the Health Licensing Division of the Department of Human Services. I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2800 as it is currently written with the amendments. As you will hear a bit later this morning, the situation at Oregon State Hospital is somewhat different than may be the case in our acute care hospitals in the state. You've all heard the many stories about the difficult situation at the hospital, the chronic overcrowding and understaffing under which we're currently laboring. The Department of Human Services is certainly very committed to a safe and high-quality nursing care environment, and applaud the efforts of the Oregon Nurses Association and other members of the nursing community in pursuing attempts to improve the working conditions in our state hospital. However, as the bill is currently written, including the amendments, it would create an untenable situation at the state hospital and also result in rather large fiscal impacts. The first issue has to do with the number of mandates that occur at the state hospital. In the year 2004, the number of mandates which nurses had to work at would have been equivalent to 71 full-time equivalents, additional nurses that would have to be hired by the hospital to fulfill just the baseline nursing requirements. Currently, we lack about 15% to 20% of our nursing positions at the hospital in terms of unfilled vacancies at the present time, which we're unable to fill despite concerted efforts to do so. The second issue about the bill that gives us a pause is the ability of nurses to refuse admission or to care for patients in overcrowded wards. The situation at the hospital, as you've all heard, is one that is a very difficult one at the present time, and we are currently, as of today, about 50 patients over our budgeted capacity at the hospital. The Oregon State Hospital does not make decisions regarding who gets admitted to the hospital. the federal and state courts have made it clear that they have the decision-making power to do so. In addition, the Psychiatric Security Review Board makes a determination when people are returned to the hospital should they run into difficulty in the community. The section of the bill would also result in a number of complaints increasing under the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which would create problems for the hospital as well as potentially acute care hospitals as well. The inclusion of licensed LPNs and certified nursing assistants would result in similar kinds of problems for the hospital, both in terms of the numbers that remain unfilled, the positions that remain unfilled, as well as the numbers that would need to be increased to avoid the number of mandates that we are currently utilizing. Finally, Section 2 of this bill, and I believe in the amended version as well, would, according to our Department of Justice opinion, be a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act if such meetings were held on a regular basis. In summary, the department opposes this bill as written due to concerns as we outlined. I would like to say, on behalf of certainly the management of the state hospital, we do not believe that the situation involving the number of mandates with nurses is a good thing. In fact, we are doing everything we can to try to fill additional positions and to organize the hospital in ways which would allow us to use alternative methods. But unless some kind of a ramp-up time frame or a waiver for the hospital was included in the bill, I think we would be in very desperate straits in short order. Thank you for your attention.
Kathleen, did you have some comments?
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, I'm up here to answer any questions if you have any about hospital licensure, federal Medicare certification, and this impact.
Go ahead, Representative Greenleaf.
Do you run by that thing about the unfair labor practices comment that you made that your attorney suggests?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, the healthcare licensure and certification section has worked with a number of stakeholders, including the hospital staff members and the Hospital Association and the Oregon Nurses Association in writing hospital licensing rules. And several years ago, in fact, back in 2000, we had written hospital licensing rules which we proposed that would have included something along these lines, and we submitted it to the Department of Justice for a review, as we always do, and an attorney for the Department of Justice who was specializing in labor law found that, issued an opinion that the Fair Labor Standards Act would be violated based on some decisions made by the National Labor Relations Board. So,
let me just ask you to identify yourself for the record, too. You can do that before you.
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, and members of the committee, for the record, I am Kathleen Smail, a manager of Healthcare Licensure and Certification Section.
It's just that wasn't a specific referral to a specific review of this act as amended, of this bill as amended.
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlight. No, it was just related to proposed rules in 2000.
Similar rules. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me just sort of generally comment that I'm disappointed. Not in your testimony, but disappointed in general that we first learned of perhaps the impact on the state hospital on Friday as we were anticipating this public hearing. In my view, the state hospital is in a very sensitive situation right now, and we have sort of moved forward and are looking into the future, and we're not looking into the past, because I don't think that's as productive as it could be. I think the working environment is difficult, but we are looking forward to an improved working environment. There's a whole process about what the hospital is going to look like in the future, and I think relations are improving between hospital staff and the hospital administration. And so my disappointment is that I don't want this issue, this bill, to become a vehicle that is going to impede our forward progress on the hospital. And so we need to have some kind of resolution for this on the hospital. And I'm going to ask the proponents of this bill and all the stakeholders to spend some time to work through that issue, because I'm very, very adamant about moving the hospital forward. It's a huge endeavor, and we do not want to experience any setbacks in that forward progression. So it's not aimed at you, Dr. Fickle. It's aimed at the proponents of this bill. But we should have probably had a conversation about the impact on the hospital prior to this hearing. So, Dr. Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple of different questions.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Kathleen, could you go over this again about that last paragraph? I still don't understand it. So why would equal participation of management and direct care staff be a violation of the Federal Standards Act?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, the attorney for the Department of Justice based his opinion on rulings by the National Labor Relations Board, and that board had found that that establishment of a committee where one required participation of not staff voluntary, perhaps that would not be a violation.
So if it were voluntary, it would be all right?
Well, Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, I think so. I don't want to say for sure.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and the other thing is, Dr. Fickle, so it sounds like you would need to hire 71 additional staff in order to avoid the kind of provisions that this bill require. And if so, I assume that the reason you cannot hire 71 additional staff is that you don't have the funding for that?
Chairman Dalto, Representative Tomei, the question of why we have such difficulty in hiring people has to do with the fact that, frankly, we are not competitive in terms of salary nor in working conditions at the state hospital. Many hospitals, of course, are suffering from the inability to hire folks currently. We have over 30 unfilled RN positions currently. Even if those were filled, we would require another approximately 71 full-time equivalent RNs to just meet the mandated overtime that we've accrued over last year. What happens is that...
I just want to clarify that even if you hired the 30 unfilled positions, you would still require an additional 71. Is that what I'm hearing? Okay, please just say it.
Chairman Dalto, Representative Tomei, the problem lies in the fact that the hospital has been so chronically understaffed at base for so many years that the number of nurses that are required at any given moment is not even met by having all of our current positions filled. That's true not just about nurses, it's true about almost every other area of employment that you might want to look at. If you would compare this hospital, the Oregon State Hospital, with the similar staffing patterns at Western Washington State, for instance, you would find that in nearly every category, the Oregon numbers are substantially below those of Western Washington State. And in nurses, it's approximately 40% below their staffing levels. This is not a condition that's arisen overnight. And it's been one that, despite the magnificent efforts of many nurses for many years, at some point the numbers just become insufficient to meet the needs of how many patients that we have, particularly as the acuity worsens or deepens over the years.
Okay. Thank you. So you would fill these positions if you could find the people to apply for them. You're not deliberately not filling these positions. This is something that you have no control over. Am I assuming that correctly?
Vice Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we have made every effort that we can to try to fill those positions. In particular, we have utilized a wide variety of nursing agencies. We have contracts essentially with every nursing agency in this part of the state. We have contracted with a variety of nursing agencies that bring in what are called traveling nurses from other parts of the country. And we're actually looking at utilizing nurses from Canada through J-1 visa applications. All of these require, as you can imagine, substantial amounts of money, even over and above the salaries that we can currently offer. There's a generalized nursing shortage throughout the state, throughout most of the country, of course. This contributes to a worsening of our particular situation, since our salaries are substantially below those of that nurses can make in the private sector.
Thank you, Dr. Pickle. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments? Okay. Thanks very much. We're going to stand at ease for 60 seconds. May I see Mary? Okay, we'll come back to order. Let the audience know what's going on. There's a caucus that I'm being called to, and we want to have as many people to be able to participate in this hearing to hear from the folks that have signed up. So I'm just trying to figure out how to manage those time issues. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to, because there are some folks from the state hospital that wanted to sign up, and also some nurses, I want to give them priority so that your representatives down at the Capitol are here for the whole day so they can come back later. So what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is invite up Randy Davis and Sean Taylor and Marianne Grieve forward. Is Marianne Grieve here?
Yes.
Okay, great. Come on forward. And then we have from the various public employee unions, Mary Botkin and Lynn Marie Kreider, who will testify at another point. And then Shelda Holmes is here. Shelda, are you here? Raise your hand if you're here. Okay, we're going to have her come up next. And then we're going to recess the meeting until I can come back.
New applications. Okay,
yeah. By the way, I don't think we're going to get to House Bill 2712 or 2753 today. Let me see the sign-up sheet for that, please. Is there any member of the public that was here to testify on either House Bill 2712 or 2753? Doesn't look like there are any members of the public who are here to testify on those two bills. Okay, well, professional associations aside, we'll likely set those over to another meeting. Okay. Yeah, okay. All right. Thanks very much. Welcome. Good morning.
Morning.
Sorry that we have to change things up on you, but go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman Dalto, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Taylor. I'm a registered nurse at Oregon State Hospital, mental health, RN. I am also a member of AFSCME Local 3295, which is Nurses Local. AFSCME has been very active in the support of House Bill 2800 since inception. I've been employed at this hospital for 14 and a half years, working in all geriatric and forensic units one time or another while either working overtime, being mandated, or through the course of my regular work hours. I have a couple comments about House Bill 2800 as it affects Oregon State Hospital. OSH is the only hospital, according to health licensure staff and other unions, that is having major difficulty complying with HB 2800. These problems have come from market comparability. Oregon State Hospital is unable to compete with private and nonprofit hospitals. We were behind market wages 2 years ago and have had a two-year wage freeze, while nurses' wages have been going up between 10 and 20%. Nurses won't work for less than market in increasingly difficult clinical circumstances. At present, Oregon State Hospital has minimum budgeted staffing of 158 RNs. 124 of those positions are filled. 10 more are operationally either vacant due to injury or illness. With 44 vacant positions, means there are 220 shifts a week that must be filled by very expensive agency nurses or members working overtime. This makes the average work week for our RNs to be 7 shifts a week, or double the cost of agency nurses to be hired. These gaps are being filled by nurses who have more dedication than sense. Some volunteers for overtime are working as many as 40 consecutive days without a day off. Exhausted nurses have more difficulty in maintaining effective therapeutic safe environments. Not knowing if you are going home at the end of your regular shift is a hardship on your personal life by making it difficult to make arrangements for activities after work hours. Nurses who have scheduled extra shifts come to work with the mindset to work an extra shift. Nurses who are mandated are thrown into a situation where they have to reschedule their plans, by example, arranging childcare, rescheduling appointments, or giving up time with family and friends. Therefore, facing another 8 hours of work with loss of sleep. After time, this starts to affect a nurse's ability to make decisions and lead to burnout. 12 months ago, Oregon State Hospital hired 42 RNs. As of the end of last month, only 21 are still working there. House Bill 2800 provides a baseline, an early warning system, and standard for minimal staffing of RN positions, and should be expanded to monitor all licensed direct care providers. The original bill passed last session was a major contributor to the understanding and addressing staffing needs for RNs. My hope is that more can be done to amend the bill to give it more enforceability that can resolve mandations at Oregon State Hospital. Thank you, Chairman Dalton.
Thanks, Sean. Marianne, good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Chairman Dalton, members of the committee. My name is Marianne Grieve. I, too, am a registered nurse at Oregon State Hospital. I don't have formal testimony for you this morning, but I have two articles that I've submitted about sleep deprivation. The first one, I want to draw your attention to the daylight savings time, the brief one here. And if you look down here, and it talks about... The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that sleep deprivation leads to about 100,000 reported crashes each year on roads across the nation. And followed by that, it says officials are urging Oregonians to go to bed as early as possible Sunday night and try to get a little extra rest before making the Monday morning commute. If you are experiencing a little sleep deprivation, imagine how that works when you have been mandated and have worked extra hours and you're retired and you're responsible for the care of patients. The other thing I want to, keeping this brief, is psychiatric nursing is not well understood. We are registered nurses. We do medications. We do treatments. We give injections. But in psychiatric nursing, the nurse really becomes the tool. And we have to be very tuned in to subtle changes in behavior. We have patients who cannot communicate their needs very well due to psychosis or other problems. And we have to be finely tuned into these very subtle changes. And when you're sleep deprived and you've worked 16 hours, you might miss a critical incident. So we are in very much support of this bill. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for working at the hospital.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much. Brandy, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Dalton. My name is Randy Davis, for the record. I'm employed at the Oregon State Hospital as a mental health therapist, too. As a mental health therapist, too, there are roughly 450 of us that work at all three campuses of the state hospital between Salem, Portland, and Pendleton. And each person in the MHT class, that's mental health therapist class, is required to maintain a certified nurse's assistant licensure. So we have 450 employees that work as CNAs. And these employees are the direct care line staff that work with the patients every day. And the hospital is really unique in its own way, and I think that Dr. Fickle made that pretty clear. The hospital is unique among other hospitals. They don't have control over who comes into the hospital. The law denotes who comes to the hospital, and there are a lot of external factors on how we can get people out of the hospital. So we don't have that ability to ebb and flow for admissions and discharge like a private hospital does. We're required by law to accept people, and we're held at the constraints of the community for placement in the PSRB for placement of patients. So the hospital, with that happening, faces an overpopulation crisis that's supported with an understaffing crisis. So every day at the hospital, there's numerous hours of voluntary overtime work. So I really would like to focus on the difference between a voluntary overtime and a mandated overtime. That seems to be lacking in the conversation here. It was briefly mentioned by some of the nurses from one of the private hospitals. Voluntary overtime is one thing. Voluntary overtime, when a person volunteers for overtime, they usually do it far in advance, and at least a day in advance. And it allows a person time to mentally prepare for what's coming at them. They arrange their personal lives. They have a chance to mentally and physically adjust. They get more sleep. They know if they have to work extra hours in advance. So they are prepared to face the challenge of working more than their regularly scheduled shift. That's pretty common, and I think in most healthcare facilities you will find numerous people working extra hours, and not just within the nursing field, within all the peripheral fields as well, because of the demands of the healthcare industry. Mandated overtime, on the other hand, is that overtime that happens when there's not enough staff to work, when the patient population exceeds the demands of the nursing staff that are available. And mandated overtimes are those overtimes that we can't prepare for. No one goes to work, or should go to work, I should say, prepared to have to work more than their regularly scheduled shift based upon their personal lives being put at risk. When you're mandated, you face that stress of what happens in my personal life now, and am I going to be working in the same area of the hospital? The state hospital, they can move you from one area to another if you're mandated. Will I be working with the patient population I'm aware of? Will they mandate me to work in a part of the hospital that I'm not familiar with? And I'm sure that this has probably happened within the private hospital system, too. I'm not very familiar with that. I don't work in the private hospital system, so I don't know. So when we're talking about mandated overtimes, that this is what the bill is addressing. That last minute, by the way, you're going to have to work an extra 8 hours because we're over census and understaffed. I provided some information in the last two pages of my written testimony. These are mandated numbers, hours of mandated overtime work at the hospital just in the MHT class. This does not count the nurses. This is just the CNAs. And I think Marvin Fickle touched on this. This is quite a number. I don't have the last 3 months of 2004, but through September, there is roughly 6,000 hours of mandated overtime. And mandated overtime probably represents maybe 20% of all of the overtime work at the hospital. A lot of things have been done at the hospital to try to reduce that. They've hired a number of people, but no matter how many people we hire, it seems like we're always having more and more issues with that. More and more people, less and less staff. It seems like no matter how many positions we add.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a
question?
I just want to clarify.
All right.
Explain what this. So, on the third line down, fourth.
I can.
Over. So it says 36 MVT, and under that is 45. Was that 45 hours of overtime in addition to the 36?
Representative Tomei, I'm not exactly sure where you're looking at on my... Which,
okay.
Okay, you're looking at the one that's labeled sent.
One, okay. Two, three, down.
Mm-hmm.
One, two, three,
oh, there are,
over.
Excuse me, Representative Tomei, there are some handwritten numbers that are on the inside of this. Those, I'm sorry, I should explain that. Those are numbers adjusted by counts done by staff that work on those current units that dispute the number of overtimes worked. They're saying the staff kept a running record of, based on how they keep track of overtime, saying that the numbers that were actually recorded by the staff that work it were higher than the numbers that were maintained in the record system. So when you see a handwritten number that appears higher or lower next to a printed number, those numbers would represent the number of overtimes worked, and they probably have computed hours aren't in there, just the number of shifts worked. the number of mandated overtimes. And overtime at the state hospital usually indicates that a person worked an entire shift or most of an entire shift.
Ben, help me understand.
All right. I can represent Tammy.
I just want to get to that one figure. Third line down.
Mm-hmm.
One, two, three.
In the month.
Over.
If you
so
could.
There's 36 is typed in, 45 is written.
Right. 36 would be the, Representative Tomei, 36 would be the number of recorded mandated overtimes on that would be Unit 48C in the month of April.
Okay.
The staff who worked upon Unit 48C disputed that number and said that they recorded 45 overtimes in their own internal records.
Great. Thank you. That's all I needed to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. So, I would kind of like to focus a little more attention just on the fact that the Ways and Means Committee themselves currently have a budgetary proposal for policy package 141 for Oregon State Hospital overtime reduction, asking for $0.8 million for an increase in personal services for the hospital. Roughly $800,000 represents 41 line staff positions at the hospital, and that's excluding the nurses. That would just be the line staff. When we talk about deficiencies at the hospital and staffing, we talk about the overall numbers when Marvin Ficker was talking about needing that extra 100 staff. I believe he was talking beyond nurses. He's talking about LPNs and CNAs, and that would be the mental health therapists that work on the line. So currently when we talk about 71 positions being short at the hospital, it would be easy to split that between 30 nurses and 40 line staff. I believe that would be a more accurate representation for nursing care. So that the nursing shortage extends beyond the registered nurse classification.
Randy, do you think if you had that $800,000, you'd be able to actually hire those 41 additional folks? We'd like to be able to help you out here, and I wouldn't be opposed to making a recommendation from this committee to the Ways and Means folks to provide that that additional resource and adopt that policy package. The problem, I guess, that I'm having in my mind is that we have what was it, 33 vacancies right now. Will we be able to fill those 41 in your opinion?
Chairman Dalton, in my opinion, the hospital has made great strides in creating a training program, which they call a float pool program, and just recently hired roughly 20 employees. They trained them and hired them. I believe that if the hospital were able to get the $800,000 and were able to offer an open recruitment for training to teach people how to work in mental health and certify them as nurse's aide and put them on the floor, it's made a great difference within our system to lower the actual number of voluntary overtimes and mandated overtimes with the increase of this float pool. The hospital has, in my personal opinion, has made a pretty valiant effort in creating a training program to get people in. I believe another $800,000 that could be applied to a training program where the recruitment just doesn't require nurse's aides, but actually trains people how to be nurse's aides and how to work within the system. I think that would definitely be able to hire 40 people if they were to, you know, incorporate that training system.
Representative Tomei, could I ask you to work with Randy offline to get us some more information about that so that we can consider as a panel making that recommendation to the state hospital?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Dalton.
Yeah.
Just in conclusion, I really would like to see this committee support for House Bill 2800, including the amendments to include LPNs and CNAs. I don't think anyone with the state hospital or in the private sector that works as a CNA or an LPN or an RN wants to be forced to work. No one wants to think that the people taking care of you or your loved ones is forced to be there, even if they're compensated a time and a half. That forced labor upon a nurse or upon a CNA or an LPN could be that crucial difference between that person that you really care about being taken care of, getting kind and compassionate care, or getting a frustrated, stressed out nurse who's terribly afraid of making a mistake my personal opinion, it's just a not an acceptable kind of situation in the healthcare system.
Thanks, Randy. Randy, what about my concern about the possibility that a passage of a bill like this could cause problems with the relationship at the hospital between the staff and the management? I mean, I want to make sure that we're moving forward. You heard what I said before. What are your thoughts on that?
Representative Dalto, I think currently the hospital, labor, and management have a relatively good line of communication. The current hospital administration and the nursing services people, I believe, in my personal opinion, make due effort to not have mandates happen. I have talked to the people who are responsible for coordinating staff, and some of those people on some of the units are represented line staff, like myself, who are responsible for staffing, and they do everything they can to find volunteers for overtime. In some of the aspects, it's management service who does try to find the people to work voluntary overtimes. I think there would be some stress put on the relationship based on the fact that management would be forced to more eagerly pursue volunteers for overtime, and I think they do a pretty good job of that now. I don't think that it would be detrimental to the relationship, but I think it could potentially put some stress on it. But I don't think that it would cause enough stress to fractionate the hospital.
You do believe that things are getting better?
Yes, Chairman Dalton. I do definitely believe that the hospital administration currently is doing the best they can with the tools they have. And regardless, I would like to say they have that great big Craftsman tool chest that's full of stuff and they can fix everything they want. But I see people like Dr. Fickle walking around with just what appears to be that mental health screwdriver, and he needs more tools than just one.
That's great. Okay.
Other than a hammer.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it very much. Any comments from the panel? No? Okay.
Billy, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
No? That's my name.
Yeah, I know. How come nobody's talking about raising the pay level? I mean, if in fact... if the problem is they're not paid enough to attract nurses for this very difficult duty, I mean, why aren't we talking about making the pay comparable to other jobs in the community?
Can I borrow your checkbook, Representative?
I would be happy to write that check directly.
Right, okay.
I mean, we're talking about $800,000 for more positions that are underpaid.
Right.
And it seems to me we might be better off spending that $800,000 to raise the pay level so we could attract people.
I suspect they want the help before they want a pay increase. Is that right?
No, I don't think it's fair to ask him that one.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2800. We're going to do quite a bit more work on that, so I'm not sure when we will bring it up for final work session, but there is some work to be done, and so we're going to get together and work on that. With that, we'll adjourn the meeting for the day, and we'll bring the other stuff back later.
Thank you, sir.